That's where you're doing your work.
People do this. I think that's it. Ruben Marichum and Pimpin.
Is Bengali?
I am Bengali.
Your spiritual heritage.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Crossroads and the author Radhanath Swami, I welcome you all at the book read of The Journey Home, an autobiography of an American Swami. Today we have a very esteemed guest, Mr. Priyanshu Chatterjee, who I think last minute made plans to come here. Yes, thank you very, very much for that. I'll request Anusha to introduce Priyanshu to you all.
The Maharaj and all the members. Priyanshu Chatterjee is one of the very few intelligent actors I've ever known. He began his career more than a decade ago with Tumil and was a film since then. Being a Bengali character has always been very close to his heart. Currently, besides doing a lot of other films, he's doing a very interesting film which is based on Mahashweta Devi's novel Lajuma, which deals with an underground issue. I don't think I need to say more on this because I think he's perfect there, David Maharaj, and take this evening forward. Thank you so much.
Now to introduce the author who are meeting Maharaj for the first time. In 1978, at age of 19, Radhanath Swami left his family's home in America and traveled to India to live the life of a sadhu or a wandering monk. After trekking across Europe for months, often barely escaping with his life, he reached the land of the gods. Years later, he returned back to America in order to share what he had learned in India. It was an extraordinary choice, given what he had survived to get there. A journey filled with strange characters, mystical experiences, and dangerous adventures. This story is recounted in his recently published memoir, Journey Home. Reviews have called Radhanath Swami's saga at once an engaging yarn, a love story, and the evocation of a transcendent paradise in all its savagery, solitude, and splendor. Radhanath Swami emerged from his years of travel wanting to explain for the others the beauty and the rewards of a life devoted to God, and therein lay a dilemma. His many followers and friends describe him a completely selfless and consequently unwilling to take credit for his work, and restless when a spotlight is focused on him. You can see it now too. By choosing Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, a spiritual activist, as his guru, Radhanath Swami cast his fate to the wind and entered back into the society. More than a symbolic gesture of moving away from the mindset of physically renouncing the world, these were first steps towards an engaged form of devotion. This contemporary strain of bhakti or devotional yoga tradition maintains that people who are aware of their spiritual identity share an imperative to reduce suffering in the world. A view no doubt implanted in the years prior to Radhanath Swami's initiation by other teachers he had met, including Anand Mai Ma, Swami Sachidanand, the Dadai Rama, and Mother Teresa, all of whom made their experience in the journey home. For past 20 years, Radhanath Swami has guided the community development and has initiated a number of acclaimed social action programs, including the Midday Meal, which feeds more than 175,000 plates of nutritious vegetarian food daily to indigent children, missionary hospitals and eye camps, eco-friendly farms, schools and ashrams, and number of emergency relief programs throughout India. He sees life as a continuous blessing of God's grace, one follower says, and yet he never loses his humanness. His accessibility leaves people feeling that with a little sincere effort, they too will find the path to inner peace and God realization. I will now request Radhanath Swami to read his choice of some excerpts from the book. Thank you.
Of Crosswords for giving me this opportunity to be with you, and very grateful to each of you for so kindly coming this evening. I was requested to read something from the prologue of this book. How this book came to be written, I'll explain first. For about 30 years, friends and well-wishers asked me to write this book, but I was very reluctant to do so, thinking to write a book about myself was a very uncomfortable situation. But then something happened. One of my dearest friends, Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj, who was a spiritual counselor for Muhammad Ali, Nelson Mandela, Alice Coltrane, and tens and thousands of people all over the world, he was dying of cancer. He asked me to be with him and stay at his bedside until he passed from this world. We sat together for 8 weeks, hours every day, discussing spiritual subjects and focusing on the meaning of life and the meaning of death. When we really understand what death is, then we have a very deep insight on how to live a meaningful life. During that time, he asked me when I was going to write this book. And I told him, I don't want to write this book. And I gave him my reasons. And he looked at me and said, this is not your story. This is the story of a young man searching for meaning and fulfillment in life with the same questions and challenges as everyone in this world. And how a higher power, God, took you on a journey and your learned lessons that will be beneficial for so many people. If this story can help people, then you are arrogant and miserly to not write it. I still wasn't convinced. But then one day, with tears, he looked at me and said, "I'm a man on my deathbed. I ask you to promise me to write this book." And I promised. He said, "You cannot lie to a man on his deathbed." So I wrote it. And really, it's an offering to him. I would just like to read the prologue for you. I'm very grateful for our distinguished guest. As I crawled out from the icy Himalayan water of the Bagmati River, I gazed at two heaps of ashes, one from a cremation pit and the other from a sacrificial fire. I was dressed in only a loincloth, and a cold wind chilled me to the bone. An intense longing gripped me. What was I doing here, shivering, alone, nearly starving, and so far from home? Was all my searching to be in vain? I stared up at stars that were shimmering through the branches of an ancient banyan tree. Birds of the night warbled a melancholy song. Sacred fires burned brightly along the riverbank, where holy men, their hair matted like ropes hanging down below their knees, threw offerings of pungent herbs into the flames. From the smoldering remains, they scooped out handfuls of ashes and smeared them over their flesh. Completing the ritual, they marched toward the sacred shrine that I yearned to enter. It was the spring of 1971 in Pashupatinath, Nepal, where a flood of pilgrims had converged that night. Just out of my teens, I felt half a planet away from my home in suburban Chicago, and I ached for a solace of a holy place, a place where I might pray for direction. An hour earlier, I had approached an ancient temple, its towering gateway carved with mythical lions, serpents, gods, and goddesses. As I climbed up the stone steps, thrilled with anticipation, a gatekeeper whipped his club into my chest. I sunk to my knees, gasping for breath. Flanked on both sides by police, the gatekeeper blocked my path and shouted, "You are foreigner, get out." Their chief, dressed in a turban and military attire, burst forward with burning eyes and smacked his rod across a sign that read, "No foreigners allowed." "Out from here," he roared. "If you try again, you'll be severely beaten and thrown in prison, and I cannot say what the angry mobs will do." He ordered his charges to be vigilant. I had wandered to the bank of the river, crestfallen. My arduous quest for spiritual meaning had led me this far. I could not turn back. Now, watching the holy men, an idea sprang into my mind. I kneeled down at one smoldering pit where a sacrificial fire had burned and sunk both my hands deep into the warm, powdery ashes, sifting out the lumps of glowing coals. Shuddering, I plastered the ashes across my skinny body, from my matted hair to my calloused bare feet. The musty powder burned into my nostrils, choking my throat and parching my mouth. I wrapped two river-stained cotton sheets over my upper and lower body for robes and crept again toward the gate, my heart beating heavily in my chest. The same sentinels, the same guards stood with clubs in their hand, but they did not recognize me and let me pass. As I entered a vast open courtyard surrounding the ancient altar, I thought, if I am caught here, I could be killed. Several thousand people gathered in an unruly line and were waiting to see the altar. Only one person was allowed at a time. Patiently taking my place in the rear of the line, I inched forward. Suddenly, the same police chief who had stopped me earlier passed by. I gasped and turned my face away, my adrenaline surging. He stepped right in front of me, stared into my ash-covered face, then barked a question in the local Hindi language. I did not understand a word. If I spoke a single word of English here, I knew I would be finished. Receiving no reply, he stared at me and launched into a barrage of questions, this time much louder. My mind reeled with thoughts of years wasted in a filthy Nepali prison, or worse. With a blank expression, I stood motionless, knowing he was trained to detect anything suspicious. Did he recognize me? I could only guess. Another idea rose in my mind. Placing one palm over my mouth, I waved my hand side to side. Those who vow never to speak, Moni Babas, often express their vow in this way. The chief gripped my arm and dragged me away. Where was he taking me? Was I under arrest? He yelled. Instantly, two police guards came running. Surrounded, I was yanked through the line of pilgrims until I reached the place of maximum congestion. Raising their clubs, my captors roared like thunder. Was this to be a public lashing? Would the mob tear me apart for defiling their sacred shrine? They shouted louder and louder as people scattered. I waited, terrified. The men dragged me through the bustling crowd until I found myself standing directly in front of the altar. A colorful pagoda with swirls of sandalwood incense pouring out. In front stood a massive stone bowl. On the altar stood a stone figure of the deity of Shiva, adorned with embroidered silks and glittering with gold and precious jewels. The chief lifted his stick and squeezed my arm. Would he pummel me right before the holy image? Surrounded by his lieutenants, rod raised above his head, he shouted orders at a priest who rushed back into the altar. I waited, trembling. From the inner sanctuary, the high priest appeared, dressed in robes of red silk. A striking red circle of powder marked his forehead, and he wore a gold necklace and a strand of dried Rudraksha seeds around his neck. In a deep, hypnotic tone, he recited the mantra, Om Namah Shivaya. My captor, his stout body sweating profusely despite the chilly wind, yelled something to the priest that I again could not understand. The high priest listened intently. He nodded his head, closed his eyes, and paused. Moments passed as the mass of pilgrims clamored impatiently. Then, straightening his posture, the high priest took a deep breath and began to recite incantations from ancient Sanskrit texts. He stunned me by wrapping a silk turban around my head. Then he draped a shawl over my shoulders, placed several jasmine and night queen garlands around my neck, anointed my forehead with sandalwood paste, and offered me saffron-flavored water to drink. Standing in a daze, I realized that the police were holding the massive crowd back in order to grant me an exclusive opportunity to worship the Lord and be honored by the temple. Bowing low with humility, the police chief then begged with joined palms for my blessings and departed. Did he not recognize me in my disguise? Or was he aware who I was and simply honoring my determination? This I will never know. Whatever the reason, I was deeply humbled. I had defied human law and deserved to be beaten. But God is merciful. Standing before the altar, my limbs covered with ashes, my drab ascetic robes and tangled, matted hair awkwardly covered with silks and flowers, I squeeze my tearing eyes shut, join my palms, and prayed that I would be shown my true path as I continued my journey. I returned to the riverbank and sat on the cold earth. It was a moonless night. Stars glittered in the dark sky. A breeze filled the forest with the scent of blooming jasmine, and the cooing of an owl emerged out of the silence. Gazing downstream, I wondered where the river of destiny would lead me next. How did I land into a life so foreign to my upbringing, but so familiar to my soul? This book is about a boy who spent his teenage years in the turbulent era of the 1960s in America. A time when the Vietnam War was raging. And when you became 18 years old, you were subject to forcibly be drafted into the army, whoever you were. If you didn't have an excuse, the government accepted, and sent to fight a war that most of the youth of my generation considered to be immoral and useless. I saw friends and brothers of my dear friends killed, coming back injured, or as alcoholics and drug addicts due to the anxiety, their lives ruined. At the same time, in the 50s and 60s of America, the African American people, they may have legally been free from slavery, but 98% had no choice but to live and die in the ghetto, with no opportunities for proper education and no equal rights. Dr. Martin Luther King, inspired by Mahatma Gandhi, established a civil rights movement. He wanted, through peaceful means, to boycott prejudice and injustices and bring freedom from his people. But there were others who were not so patient. In the 1960s, cities were being burned in revolt for prejudice. There was war. In Vietnam, there was literally a war between the young generation of the counterculture and the older generation. There were marches, there were bombings of draft boards, and the civil rights movement. There was both peaceful and violent battles in every city of America. This was the 1960s. Many young people in that environment questioned, what is the use of our upper class, upper middle class, and middle class comforts when there's such contradiction, hypocrisy, and turmoil all around us? And many millions of people in the young generation revolted. Some turned to music for answers. But unfortunately, I saw most of the prophets of the music, many of them died at the age of 27 due to overdose of drugs. Did they have the answers? People were taking to intoxications and various forms of psychedelic and other drugs to try to attain higher consciousness or relief. Many of their lives were being ruined. Others took to the street to fight. I tried it. I was tear gassed by the Chicago police at a civil rights demonstration. I had bottles and stones thrown at me by my fellow white people for wanting to speak up in a march for the rights of the African American people. I was confused, troubled. I know many Indians, they really want to go to America for a peaceful life. But in those days, it was not like that. Something in my heart moved me in a direction that was completely different from anybody that I personally knew or grew up with. I turned for spiritual answers. Started reading books on world religions by philosophers and saints of different traditions. But then I was thinking, as long as I'm isolated culturally in the environment that I was brought up with, I'll never really be able to see beyond what I'm taught to believe. So I decided to travel to different parts of the world to see how different people and different races view life, how they perceive God, how they develop relationships, what are their values. I went to Europe with one friend, and we had another friend who had all our money. Actually, it was all his money because we had no money. And by God's grace, the first day we arrived in Luxembourg, he was robbed. And we had no money between the three of us. So he took his return ticket and went back. And my friend Gary and I decided, now we have no money, we're free. We're completely dependent on the grace of God. That's what we wanted, isn't it? So we hitchhiked. We developed a strategy of where we were going to go. We would stand on a roadside like this, and wherever the car was going that picked us up, that's where we were supposed to go. I learned many things. But through my travels and experiences, this spark of desire for spiritual experience was growing into a flame. And ultimately, on an island of Greece, Gary and I were living in a cave. And I was meditating and studying spiritual books and praying from sunrise to sunset every day. And it was in that place that that flame grew into a blazing fire. It was time to return home. I went to about a year of college, and I promised my parents I would be home after the summer vacation to continue my college. But I knew that I would be an empty shell if I did not follow the calling of my heart. I heard a voice that told me to go to India. So I left my friend and hitchhiked across Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And this little boy who was so quiet that all his teachers would complain to his mother, "Your son, little Richie, never says anything." That was me. And now I was in the Himalayas, living with rishis and sages that were 3 times my age, sometimes 4 times my age, as their apprentice, as their student, studying animals, studying nature, trying to find meaning and fulfillment in life, trying to make real sense in this troubled world. The world isn't much different now. It never has been, and whether it ever will be. Greed, envy, war, selfishness has always so deeply affected human society. Trying to find that place within ourselves where we have a strong foundation of truth, where we could live with integrity despite the ever-changing situations of this world, where we can find happiness and joy, because actually happiness and joy is a matter of the heart. It's not a matter of things cannot bring you real happiness. Happiness is of the heart. It's within us. It needs to be awakened. I understood this in my travels. I wanted to find that. I wanted to have something that I could share with others that was meaningful and real. And that's the subject matter of this book. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, and sorry for this really enlightening and gripping prologue. Can I request you could give a few words and
would like to sit there?
Swamiji, thank you. Thank you for making me a part of this. Good evening, friends. It's just been a huge stroke of luck for me to be able to be a part of this. I was here for some other work, but my dear friend Yogesh, I'm sure they brought me here, and it's been beautiful listening to Swamiji's words, and I look forward to reading this book soon myself, whenever it's out. Thank you once again for having me here.
Thank you, Bhim.
Could I give you this book?
No. I'll buy one copy.
Right. Before we close this program, I really urge to all to please possess. Today is an opportunity to get an autographed copy of the author here. Just to give you some statistics. Now, we launched this book about 2 months back internationally, and we have already sold more than 25,000 copies in India and internationally. We've got excellent reviews from great thinkers like B.K. Iyengar and industrialists like Yash Birla, Arvind Mafatlal, Swati Piramal, saints like Pejavar Swami, and many other literary figures worldwide. If you want to know more about this book, apart from that you bought it, you could visit, we have a website, thejourneyhomebook.com. So you get more information, and we update that website frequently, as in as we do events and we get reviews and all. So I really request to whoever doesn't have, please take a copy, and this is an opportunity to get this for Radharan Swami this time. Thank you very much.